This show is brought to you by the Podcast Network. If you're interested in finding out about some of our other shows, or you would like to advertise or sponsor a show, please go to www.thepodcastnetwork.com for more details.
G'day, you're on the pod with Mick and Ken from the G'day World Podcast.
Well, let's get straight into it. I know you don't have a lot of time this morning. We appreciate you coming on and having a chat. Of course, Howard Rheingold, author, tech guru, futurist. Is that how you normally describe yourself, Howard?
No, that's normally how my speaking agent describes me.
You should hear Cameron's. You should hear Cameron's describes him. It's nothing like that at all.
How do you describe yourself, Howard?
I am a free-range instigator.
Okay. I have no idea what that means, but I like it.
Well, you know, I've spent my life resisting being put into a box, so I guess I simply have an aversion to try to put an easy label on things, but I am a writer. I write books, although I spend more and more of my time communicating in other media, doing speaking, blogging, participating in online communities. I have been a writer my entire adult life, and I have been, by virtue of living in Silicon Valley and being interested in using technologies to help me write, have been, over the last 20 years, more and more drawn into looking at what technologies are enabling us to do to ourselves and our communities and our societies, and trying to figure out where that goes. And I sort of resist self-describing myself as a futurist because it's a little bit of a hype category, but I do spend time thinking about where is this all going and how can it be better explained to people.
I mean, you have been on the cusp since the early 80s. You've been on the cusp of introducing sort of new technologies and being involved in new technologies, right back from the well through to the, you know, Tools for Thought, which I think was the first book of yours that I ever read in the mid-80s.
I'm delighted to hear about that because that book sank like a stone 20 years ago. But since then, I've discovered that of the few thousand copies that were actually sold, a lot of interesting people were influenced.
Well, I had a book given to me. I had it given to me by my first computer teacher. I think said, "You're going to love this. Here, you take this away." This is while we were running BBSs and a whole heap of things online in those days. So it was one of those. Your books happen to appear at defining moments in sort of technology as it's being appreciated by the rest of the world. You know, as you go through Tools for Thought, virtual reality, virtual communities books, smart mobs. There's a definite pattern developing there.
Yes. I couldn't see the pattern before, but I'm seeing it now. And I'm a little bit trapped in that as a writer, in that writers usually have the luxury of deciding what they're going to write about. I can't really create a defining pattern. I can only discern it. So I think I was accurate in the 1980s at seeing that the PC was going to become much more powerful and much more important and much more an extension of our minds. And I think I was correct in the late 1980s, early 1990s in seeing that social communication on the internet was going to be important. And more recently with smart mobs, seeing that the merger of the mobile telephone, the internet, and the PC is enabling yet another kind of major change, but I can't really tell you when the next time is going to come along.
I was about to say, the venture capitalists must be waiting for your next book to see what the next thing's going to be.
Yeah, you know, I actually was an entrepreneur at one point. I had something called Electric Minds, I actually went and pitched venture capitalists and talked one of them into giving me $2 million, and which I burned very quickly. I learned a lot of things. I learned how quickly you can spend $2 million of somebody else's money. I learned how little $2 million is if you're trying to build a business. I learned that if a venture capitalist gives you $2 million, they want $20 million back, and they want it very, very quickly. So that was a wonderful education in capitalism, although I will have to say extraordinarily painful. I am not built to be an entrepreneur, and I now understand things that I did not understand before. I think a lot of intellectuals, I suppose you would call me something of an intellectual, although I'm not in the academy, have an unearned contempt for people who meet a payroll. And I will always respect anybody who can honestly or semi-honestly meet a payroll. It's not easy to do. And managing people is not easy to do. So I know things about business that I didn't know before. It was, as I said, a painful experience, but an education being in the middle of the venture capital bubble. It was not the internet bubble, by the way. It was the venture capital bubble.
And that, you know, talking about venture capital and capitalism raises an interesting question. I read an interview, I think, with you about 6 or 7 months ago, where you were riffing on the idea that there are a lot of large established companies in the United States with a lot of lobbying power who are trying to squash some of the emerging technologies on the internet, like peer-to-peer file sharing technologies as one example, and that these technologies could do one of two things, or these companies trying to squash these two technologies could do one of two things. It could lead to a new economic system that supplants capitalism as, you know, I guess, the what is seen as the most successful economic system that we've seen to date. And secondly, you talked about how if the US tries to squash the emergence of these technologies, countries like China could become the breeding ground for the new economic and technological innovations, turning the US into something of a backwater. Could you explain a little bit more what your thinking is along those lines? I thought that was a fascinating point.
Well, there are actually a number of different points there. First of all, capitalism. There's earlier in the 20th century, a person who's something of a saint figure for capitalism, Joseph Schumpeter, economist, wrote about creative destruction, that for better and for worse, capitalism is sort of a Darwinian process in that a new ways of doing things, new technologies come along, and they supplant older ones. We don't see horses and buggies anymore because of the automobile. New enterprises destroy old enterprises, creative destruction. Capitalism enables this kind of creative destruction to change things. Now, that's not so good if you're in the horse and buggy business, but it's pretty good if you're Henry Ford. We're now seeing, I think for the first time in history, an attempt to kind of roll back creative destruction in the sense that you're seeing large established enterprises who don't want to see new ways of doing things, new technologies, challenge their old business model, and they are challenging this not in the market, the place where capitalism is supposed to be decided, but by spending enormous amounts of money to buy legislation and regulation in their favor. So we're seeing the recording industry and the motion picture industry with digital rights management, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act makes it illegal for somebody to sell something that enables you to fill your toner cartridges. They're calling that digital rights management, a digital rights offense. They're extending what was meant to protect intellectual property to a way of protecting old business models. And by the way, I'm all for paying the creators of intellectual property. I am one. I simply think that crippling our technologies and crippling capitalism is not the way to do it. Most people in the world don't know what's going on in that regard. You really have to be kind of a technology geek and a policy wonk to understand that the recording industry, the motion picture industry, the large owners of content, who also happen to own the conduits for broadcasting that content, they have spent a lot of money and a lot of time not only trying to lobby for regulations in their favor and laws in their favor internationally, but actually building these laws into the next generations of hardware. So if you happen to be in the future using a digital camera and Mickey Mouse happens to be in the background, well, the camera will shut itself off. I think people who use the Apple iPod, extraordinarily popular device, now find that they can't move some of the things that they buy from Apple's music store to their own computers. We no longer own the content that we buy when we buy a tune. We lease it. We are entering a pay-per-view society in which you don't really own the things that you buy, the music, the software. You lease it, and the companies you lease it from can make your ways of accessing those obsolete. There's a popular tax package in the USA, I don't know about elsewhere, called Quicken, an enormous enterprise. They cripple their software every year. You can't use it to do your taxes and file electronically. You have to buy the new version. So that's I'm just getting started on that. I don't think that that's really healthy. I think that's going to slow innovation. We're seeing the same thing with radio spectrum that's regulated according to the way technologies were in the 1920s. Now we have new ways of using spectrum. We should have new ways of regulating it. That's where China comes in. If China says, well, you know, the U.S.'s Federal Communications Commission stops at the borders of China, we don't need to participate in these intellectual property treaties if they're going to slow our development. We don't want to buy Microsoft. I think we're going to use open source software. They are already having an enormous impact. So as China goes, so goes the world in the 21st century.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, the way that we're doing this call is another example of some of the workarounds to these sorts of situations. You know, the fact that we're making a telephone call over using Skype between two countries, and it's, you know, costing us literally nothing because the costs are already factored into our bandwidth costs. It must be causing some concern to the FCC, I imagine.
Well, you know, the FCC, they are supposed to take care of what the citizens own on our behalf. We've sort of lost sight of that because they're more or less mouthpieces for the companies that spend the most money lobbying them. But why should the fact that a new technology, voice over internet protocol, enables us to make telephone calls, why should that be a problem for consumers? It should be a problem for the horse and buggy manufacturers. Ironically, the telephone companies, the ones who are the most threatened, they were the ones who rejected packet switching back when the ARPANET first started. They said it would never work to send information around that way. So it's sort of their problem. If they want to stay in business, they're going to find a way to deal with it. Why should it be illegalized? Should the automobile have been illegalized because it was a problem for horses and buggies? I don't get it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So one last question, and then we'll let you get back to what you're doing there, Howard. I'm really interested in some of your ideas around smart mobs and disaster relief, particularly what we've seen happen over the last month around the Indian Ocean. Are you seeing that these technologies are being used for good in an effective way?
Well, you know, I recently wrote an article about that because so much happened. So quickly in that regard. I wrote an article for thefeature.com called Smart Mobbing Disaster Relief, in which, you know, I only had less than 1,000 words. I could have written much more about that. So much had happened. And it was interesting in that these ad hoc efforts piggybacked on existing social networks. There were bloggers in India who immediately set up an online site as a clearinghouse for information about people who wanted to contribute to legitimate relief agencies. And of course, the citizen contributions, I think through Amazon.com, USA citizens contributed something like $9 million during the week it was taking the U.S. government to decide that they would contribute $15 million. Of course, the U.S. government later upped the ante, maybe out of because they were shamed. But what was interesting was that citizens now have a way of sending their $50 contributions and having an honest broker, a trusted broker, send that money to where they think it's going to go. We also saw, well, one really interesting example was that a friend of mine in Helsinki runs a website there for Finnish scuba divers. A lot of Finns go to Thailand in the wintertime to do scuba diving. So there was a network of dive shops that were connected to the internet and Finns who were interested in going there that had previously existed. You know, as soon as the tsunami happened, people with cell phones who were connected to that network in Thailand were calling in, sending SMS messages to the person running this website in Finland. That website was a better source of information about people who were not missing than the Finnish State Department was. So there were examples after example of people putting together information about who was missing and who was not missing, people sending money, people helping direct disaster relief to places, reports that were much, much faster than the standard news media, all thrown together really in a matter of hours. And I think there's never going to be a substitute for the kind of trained, well-equipped, experienced disaster relief on the spot. But we now have all sorts of worldwide citizen-based ad hoc media that can spring into action. And now that we've seen how that worked and did not work, a lot of people are thinking about how can we do better next time.
So have you seen a lot of the stuff that you, I mean, obviously what you've talked, you know, you've got a lot of stuff there that's what you wrote about in 2002 for Smart Mobs. You're starting to see the emergence of that sort of stuff start to happen and, you know, the ability for the people to use the mobile phones in those sorts of scenarios and, you know, the rise of the portable devices. Are you seeing a lot of what you wrote about in Smart Mobs that's actually sort of coming to bear? Or do you think we're still a while away from some of this stuff?
Well, of course, it's happening every day. If you go to my blog, smartmobs.com, you'll see that there's, you know, 6, 7, 8, or 10 things happen every day that are what we call smart mobby, that are in that category of collective action that's enabled by mobile devices and the internet. Politically, we've seen the Korean elections tipped. We saw in Kenya the elections were kept honest. We saw in the USA the Dean campaign, and also both the Republicans and the Democrats using the internet for fundraising. We saw the kind of frivolous flash mob phenomenon a year ago sweep around the world. Almost every day there is something that happens at the intersection of mobile telephony, internet communications, and collective action, whether it's political or social. Or cultural. I think we're really at the beginning of the era still, but there's a lot happening.
Fabulous. Well, look, Howard, we'll let you get back to what you're doing. Are you working on another book today?
I'm working on what I call the Cooperation Project. You can go to cooperation.smartmobs.com and find out about that. But I don't know whether it's going to be a book, but I'm interested in going beyond technology to learn more about the scientific dynamics, sociology, economics, biology, political science, computer science, behind human cooperation and collective action. And what are the obstacles to that?
Fascinating. Well, we look forward to keeping a tab on that. Thanks very much. We really appreciate you taking the time to come on. It's been fascinating. Have a great day.
My pleasure.
Thanks very much, Howard.
Cheers, Howard.
Bye-bye.
off for a wee out again. Ash McKinfield, off the Murray, got it.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you'd like to find more great podcasts, then head over to the Podcast Network. You can find us at www.thepodcastnetwork.com.
G'day, world. G'day, Mick. How are you, my buddy?
G'day, Cam.
This is Jeremy Wright for the Podcast Network, and this is the Biz
Blog. I'm looking for Claiborne. Do you
G'day,
know
everybody,
where...
and welcome to the Gadget Show. Today
hey,
we're
how you doing? I'm Dubba. It's the Jazz Show on the Podcast Network. The
welcome
best
to
jazz
the Tablet PC Show. My name is James Kendrick. Today is Sunday,
welcome
March
3rd. Welcome to the second Mobiles Podcast on the Podcast Network. This is Ewan Spence.
It's the Movie Show! G'day, Ewan.
And bye for action!
Hello, G'day. Everybody, and welcome to this edition of the Tech Addiction Show. The Tech Addiction Show.
G'day, folks. Welcome to the VC Show. It's Wednesday, the 9th of March, 2005. Just
say yes! Say yes to podcasting at www.thepodcastnetwork.com.